This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
famine may be ebbing in South Sudan, but the government and UN agencies say the situation across the country remains dire. They say the number of people struggling to find food each day has risen from 4.9 million in February to 6 million today.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details next.
Also, Pope Francis has pledged to give more than $500,000 for humanitarian aid in South Sudan. And thousands of Nigerian refugees returning from Cameroon are overwhelming the border town of Bangui.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, a massive humanitarian response has eased the famine in parts of South Sudan. Despite that, more people are now facing hunger as the conflict there continues. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Famine may be ebbing in South Sudan, but the government and UN agencies say the situation across the country remains dire. They say the number of people struggling to find food each day has risen from 4.9 million in February to 6 million today. The Food and Agriculture Organization representative in South Sudan, Serge Tissot, says that's the highest level of food insecurity ever in the country. There are also very high levels of acute malnutrition. Even though famine has eased in parts of the former Unity and Jonglei states, Tissot says 45,000 people there face catastrophic conditions. They could face starvation if emergency aid is not sustained.
We have still a situation that looks like famine for many people.
He says famine is the highest stage of food insecurity, but many people in South Sudan are very close to entering it as the conflict goes on.
The main reason is the deterioration of the security in many locations. In the past, we had only three states on the conflict. Now we have problem of security quite everywhere in South Sudan. So we have new location where people are leaving the village. So we have less farmer growing crops, so less food available.
Tissot says there's also what he calls indirect impact of the conflict,
where people rely only on the market. As there is less food available in the countries, there is less food available on the market. So people have a lot of problem to find food in those locations, even if there was no direct conflict. And due to the current economical situation and the inflation, people are not even able to purchase what's available on the market.
As a result, more than 50% of South Sudan's population needs humanitarian assistance. That includes food, water, sanitation, and medical care, along with the distribution of seeds, farming tools, fishing gear, and livestock vaccinations. The FAO official says emergency assistance will be needed for the long term.
It's also important to know that this crisis will not end shortly.
Tissot says many farmers have fled their fields and are in refugee camps in Uganda. They missed this year's planting season, so few, if any, good harvests are expected in 2017. The FAO is already looking ahead to next year.
So South Sudan will remain food insecure in 2018 due to the current insecurity in the country.
UN agencies continue to use helicopters and airdrops to bring food to communities cut off by conflict. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, on South Sudan, a rights group says thousands of people in the Upper Nile region have been forcibly displaced in the last few months. Amnesty International blames government forces, saying they burned, shelled, and looted homes. It accuses them of deliberate killings and indiscriminate attacks. Amnesty says some of the victims were elderly or disabled. Joanne Mariner is Amnesty's senior crisis response advisor. From New York, she spoke to reporter Ayan Bior about the government's offensive in the Upper Nile.
During that offensive, tens of thousands of members of the Shilluk minority in South Sudan were forcibly displaced from their towns and villages. So right now, the region is largely empty of the civilian population. People have fled to Sudan. People are living in very difficult circumstances in displaced persons camps, and people are at the protection of civilian site in Malakal, but very few people now are living in their villages.
The report says that at least 40,000 people have fled to Abaruk. What are the conditions there? I understand that it's not a displacement camp.
It's not an official displacement camp. It's really just an ad hoc site that had some level of protection from government forces where people congregated. At the very height of the conflict in early May, there were some 40,000 people. That number has shrunk tremendously as people have fled to other areas, primarily Sudan. So right now, there are approximately 10,000 people living in very difficult circumstances because it just doesn't have the conditions to support that kind of population. There's very little water. The water that there is tainted. Because of that, they've already had an outbreak of cholera in May. And it's also very difficult for humanitarian organizations to bring in food. So there's a shortage of both food and water, obviously not easy for civilian life.
Now, you were just in the Upper Nile. You had a chance to speak directly with civilians there. What are they telling you personally?
We interviewed dozens of both victims and eyewitnesses to abuses in Abruç, the displacement camp, and at the UN's Protection of Civilians site. And civilians described government attacks on their towns and villages, deliberate killing of civilians, indiscriminate attacks, primarily shelling of civilian villages, but also a bombing in one case by an Antonov plane. They described systematic and massive looting. So once the attack was over, both government and militia forces just stole basically everything they could get their hands on in these towns and villages. So, you know, everything from furniture and even the doors off of homes to clothing and even people's food. The looting of people's food stores is especially important given the difficult humanitarian conditions. So it really makes it difficult for people to return to their homes when they don't have food to eat. We spoke to a number of elderly civilians. I mean, I guess one point that's important to make is that some number of elderly civilians were burned alive in their houses because, you know, people who are very old, people who are vulnerable, unable to walk, are not able to flee when the government's carrying out an offensive like this one. So they're left behind in their homes, and when those homes are shelled and burned, as we saw at a fairly massive level during this offensive, people die or burn to death inside their homes.
What needs to happen for atrocities as the ones that you have mentioned? What needs to happen for us to bring an end to them?
I mean, most importantly, of course, the onus is on the government of South Sudan to rein in its forces. It needs to discipline its forces. It needs to punish those forces that carry out these kinds of abuses. But given the situation where you have these undisciplined forces carrying out systematic atrocities, we're also calling on UN peacekeepers to increase their efforts to protect civilians. What we'd like to see is UN peacekeepers deploying in some of these areas where civilians are very much at risk, and specifically in this area of Upper Nile, where at present, it's very difficult for civilians to return to their towns and villages.
That's Joanne Mariner, Amnesty International Senior Crisis Response Advisor from New York. She spoke to reporter Ayan Bior.
Also, Pope Francis has pledged to give more than $500,000 for humanitarian aid in South Sudan. The Vatican made the announcement at a press conference today. Reporter Josephine McKenna was there. She explains why the Pope wants the world to put a greater focus on the people of South Sudan.
He feels that the world needs to wake up and be aware of what's going on there, the terrible humanitarian crisis that's affecting millions of people. And today, Cardinal Peter Turkson, who represents the Pope on peace and refugee issues, he held a press conference at the Vatican to announce that this money will be spent to finance two hospitals, a school, and farm equipment as well. And this is all about the Vatican and the Catholic Church wanting to show solidarity, but in particular, the Pope himself really wanting to put his stamp on this. And this whole effort is called the Pope for South Sudan. He wants to increase aid, increase awareness around the world so that governments increase aid, and also to find a peaceful solution to the ongoing conflict there. Now, Cardinal Turkson spoke about the conflict and the crisis, which he said is now affecting 7.3 million people, who he said were suffering daily from hunger.
Who else participated in this press conference?
We also had representation from Michelle Roy, the Secretary General of Caritas International, and he too spoke about the dire situation there. He said the numbers of people affected are huge and increasing by the day. He said there's a real risk that the famine will be worse than anything seen in the past. And he said really people are struggling to survive with their life. In 2017, Caritas and its support organizations plan to spend around $30 million bringing food to people there and helping them really to try and ease the malnutrition and stop people dying of hunger.
Was there any more mention of the Vatican, a delegation going to South Sudan in the near future?
As we know, Pope Francis was hoping to go to South Sudan later this year. That trip has been delayed, and Cardinal Turkson from the Vatican said himself that conditions had deteriorated so much. I imagine a reference there to the security situation, so that the Pope had to postpone that visit. Now, he had hoped to visit South Sudan in October to draw attention to the plight of the people in South Sudan, but it seems like that will have to be delayed now. So we don't know when the Pope will actually make it to that part of the world to raise awareness. But in the meantime, this money will be used to really try and help resolve people who are facing some pretty grave difficulties. And just today, Cardinal Turkson, for example, said that 1.5 million people had been forced to flee their villages because of war. There were massacres and atrocities happening all over the country, and too many women and children were subjected to daily violence, rape and abuse, as well as obviously men, women and children in other parts of the country also being affected by this terrible conflict. Now, as part of this campaign, the Vatican and its partners want to promote a hashtag called hashtag South Sudan We Care. They were saying today at the press conference that this is designed to really get people talking about this crisis in order to put pressure on individual governments so that they will really look at their budgets and really take action and go beyond what is currently being given to deal with this terrible crisis. And it's not only about famine and conflict, but Cardinal Turkson stressed today that there is also a very serious risk of a cholera epidemic that is unprecedented in terms of its proportions because of what we're seeing there.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Eighteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Thousands of Nigerian refugees are returning from Cameroon, and they are overwhelming the border town of Banki. UN Refugee Agency Chief Filippo Grande says he is worried about the influx, warning the town is dangerously unprepared to receive them. Even before the refugees started to return 3 weeks ago, Banki was already hosting 45,000 people displaced by attacks by Boko Haram militants. Grande says severe overcrowding in the town is being made worse by a lack of shelter, water and sanitation. And with the rainy season approaching, he's also concerned about the disease outbreaks. Many of the Nigerians.
In Hungary, 11 men went on trial today, charged in the deaths of 71 migrants. The bodies of those from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan were found in the back of a locked, refrigerated truck in 2015. The migrants were packed in the vehicle as it traveled to Austria. Prosecutors say about a half hour after departure, they started banging on the walls and yelling that they were running out of air. Prosecutors say the defendants, mostly from Bulgaria, had smuggled about 1,200 people from the Hungary-Serbia border to Austria or Germany in 2015. All are charged with human trafficking and torture, but four are also charged with homicide with particular cruelty.
The United Nations is again appealing to donors, saying it has only one quarter of the money it needs to address ongoing humanitarian crisis. The UN has required $23.5 billion to provide aid for 20 million people in Africa and the Middle East. This includes people in South Sudan, Somalia, northern Nigeria, and Yemen. An initial appeal of just over $22 billion was issued last December, but it was raised due to flooding in Peru and growing violence in the Kasai region of the DRC.
A new report shows a sharp increase in the growth of remittances being sent home from migrants living overseas. The study by the International Fund for Agricultural Research, or IFAD, shows global increases rose by 50% over the past 10 years, including a 36% rise in money sent to Africa. Last year, total global remittances totaled $445 billion. About $60 billion came from Africans in the diaspora. Pedro de Vancelius is the head of IFAD's Remittances, Migration and Development Program. He explained to reporter William Eagle that nearly 75% of all remittances are used for immediate domestic use.
Putting food on the table, the majority of the remittances are used for this as well in their daily consumption. Put better food on the table, nutrition concerns for your kids, but also better education for your kids, healthier, being able to afford the right medicine to ensure that their loved ones are taken care of. And of course, the impact that this has on gender. For the first time, the numbers of migrant female and male is equal. There is 100 million women sending money back home and 100 million men doing the same. This actually has a very empowering effect for 100 million women because, of course, they have not only now to take a job, earn, be able to remit, save, and in many cases invest part of their earnings. We believe that this is a very empowering act. And of course, for those that receive these remittances, women receiving this, now heads of households, we understand that as well, managing those financing, savings, in many cases, the majority of women invest in these so they can reunify the families.
Do we have any information on how remittances are working to either help or pose a challenge to African refugees today, particularly those who are risking going to Europe? Are they able to use the remittance system either from family in their home country sending money to them in Europe or the other way around?
It's actually both of those. When you look at corridors, for instance, that we have done back from Syria, Turkey, and Germany, we've seen that remittances flow in exactly every direction. And this just showcases a very important and specific fact is when a refugee has his migration pattern a little bit less planned than economic migrant, the risks, however, for many remain not the same potentially, but similar. An economic migrant, many of those also take great chances. But the need, of course, is what drives this. So for many of the refugees that have family members behind and felt compelled to leave their home communities, sometimes with no means, we have seen remittances going the other way until a situation can be stabilized and an income-generating activity is provided. And once this happens, then you can see an inverse flow of financial support or remittances in most of the cases. So for African, of course, but the interesting aspect, if you look in the long term, which we've done for the case of Somalia, we saw that, of course, Somalia went through this phenomenon of having to migrate or refugees leaving, and we saw the resulting phenomenon of support through remittances. But further down the road, we saw phenomena of investment. So yesterday's refugees for Somalia are today's investors in Somalia. They're the one or one of the main contributors to the reconstruction of Somalia. We have basically what they are called angel investors. They're investing in their communities. They should be helped. We should make sure that every dollar that is sent either on remittances or invested by the diaspora counts.
Also, how can states and governments better take advantage of this lucrative source of money, these remittances, in order to further their own development policies?
This is private money. Of course, the first thing is what not to do, not tax it. Many countries have actually thought about, let's tax the money. Well, that's maybe the worst thing to do because nobody's interested in double taxing. You should make the same approach that you have for foreign direct investment. You wanted to make it easier to come in and have more impact. The private sector needs to identify viable mechanisms that address the needs of migrants.
Pedro De Vasconcelos is the head of EFAD's Remittances, Migration and Development Program. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
The European Union is assuming the leadership of a global initiative to prevent gender-based violence during humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on the Call to Action program, which was launched in Sweden in 2013.
Violence against women and girls is one of the most prevalent human rights violations in the world. The United Nations and many human rights organizations have documented tens of thousands of cases of rape, sexual abuse, and exploitation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and other places of conflict. Violence during times of war and natural disasters also affects men and boys. So the European Union's call to action on protection from gender-based violence is inclusive of both sexes and all ages. The EU says its mission is to strengthen awareness and encourage the humanitarian community to take stronger action to protect women, men, girls, and boys in crisis zones. Monique Paria is Director General for European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations. She says more must be done to prevent gender-based violence from occurring in humanitarian emergencies. She says many simple measures can be taken to mitigate violence.
For instance, to have separate and properly illuminated toilets and washing facilities in camps, safe access to water and food distribution points, safe access to hospitals. That can have a very significant impact on preventing and reducing gender-based violence. We can do more also on the education to armed groups, to armies. There are a lot of activities we can try to promote so that we reduce the risk and the occurrence of these atrocities.
Paria says it is crucial to bring the Call to Action program to the field, adding it is there that these life-saving measures can have the biggest impact. Paria also says preventive actions must be taken at the earliest onset of an emergency where victims and survivors are at greatest risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a preview of the Kenyan presidential election.
the race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. The main opposition candidate is looking increasingly competitive. A discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.